Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koç is my name, Ozan İbrahim and Roddy McCune, my co-hosts. Gents, good to see you both again.
Good to be with you.
Well, starting with the bombshell this week that hit US politics, former US President Joe Biden announced he has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer. Let us take this opportunity here on Put Simply to wish Joe Biden, Dr. Jill Biden, his wife and the entire family all the very best throughout this recovery period. And we obviously hope that everything goes well. Sentiments that have been shared across the political aisle as well, from current President Donald Trump to former presidents in Barack Obama, Republicans and Democrats alike aligning in the view that their best wishes are with the former president and his wife. Except, of course, that did not last very long. Conversations around, well, how long was this known? Is this part of a grand cover-up? Timing, of course, with an important book that was released just today looking at what is alleging to be a cover-up of Biden's mental state and the fact that from Obama to other deep state institutions in the Democratic Party, knowing about this and covering it up, which is, of course, has been sort of the theme, I guess, over the last 18 to 24 months, particularly with him pulling out of the race. But let's start, Rodney, with, is there a chance here that President Biden knew about this cancer diagnosis? Is there a chance that there is a grand sort of, a chance of this grand cover-up that existed in the White House under the Biden administration? Or is this all just coincidental when it comes to timing? What's your views?
I mean, look, anything's possible. It always is, within reason. But, I mean, did he not have some publicly accepted cancer treatment in 2023 or 2022? So, I don't know. I think people are so desperate to jump on these things. It's also, as I understand it, though, obviously with no formal medical training, this is treatable. I mean, notwithstanding his age and everything else. So I'm far less excited by the he's hidden it all bandwagon that everyone's desperate to climb on board, and it feels like some sort of you can never trust the Democrats stuff. I mean, the reason he had to step down as president wasn't because of some issue around his physical health. It was an issue around his mental capacity following a debate where there was very transparent evidence of his shortcomings. I mean, there's a broader question in what level of disclosure should a candidate or a sitting leader make in terms of their own health circumstances? And is it only if it affects their ability to discharge their functions when he's not currently elected to any position? Or is it in terms of their ability to see out a term in advance of seeking election? And perhaps that's the circumstance where you'd accept some, or you'd anticipate some requirement for disclosure. But we're talking about a diagnosis after he served a term, with some people trying to argue that he must have known it whilst he was president and sought to, you know, to run for the presidency again. But look, ultimately he wasn't selected, or he was stood aside by his own party in advance of the election. And I think it's too easy to forget that the guy served as leader of his country for a period of time. He should be thanked for his service and given the best of wishes for a health recovery on this current, you know, diagnosis. So yeah, I'm not excited by the whole cover up thing, I'm afraid, on the cancer diagnosis.
I think, I mean, I agree with you. I think, people should pass on their best wishes, as we have and everyone else has. In fact, Donald Trump was very kind with his words, despite the day before calling him low IQ and saying Joe Biden was one of the most meanest people on earth. I think this is a time for kindness and best wishes. And but I do have to say that I don't think he's doing himself any favors by going on a media roadshow. I think his advisors must have, put together a plan to go out against the accusations that are supposed to be coming out in this book that's been released today, as you mentioned, Adam. And I think this was kind of to combat that. And the announcement of the cancer diagnosis again takes the attention away from some of the things that might be in that book. But yes, I think the best thing that President Biden can do to restore his legacy is keep out of the press in this instance and in the near future, because I think many people with the benefit of hindsight and with cool heads may have considered him a great president on a lot of fronts, but I think as they've had time to reflect, they've realized that he's played a very key role in the defeat of the Democrats. He should have left way earlier. And as Rodney said, I mean, you don't need to write a book about potential cover-ups. That debate performance, everyone saw with their eyes, and there is no, I mean, you can't cover that up. So I think the best thing that Democrats can do is to try and, move the agenda along. And he should help that by not making media appearances. And particularly in those media appearances, talking about how if he was still the candidate, he would actually beaten Trump. This stuff is not helpful. I think there's some tough times ahead for him. I believe it's an aggressive prostate cancer. And I think he should really look after himself and his health, and I wish his family the best. But yeah, I think this whole cover-up thing, it's really not in the interest of the Democrats to kind of be talking about this. And there'll be split on it, and they'll be talking about it. But yeah, I think very interested to read the book, and I hope to get a copy and read it as soon as possible. But from what I've read, all of the kind of pre-reviews of what's in it, etc., there seems to be a lot of anonymous reporting. And Jake Tapper, I think, has spoken to 200 people, most of whom anonymously are making comments around potential cover-up, etc. But I think, again, I don't think this is going to be, a major scandal. As Rodney said, he's moved on. He's now got a cancer battle in front of him. And at the end of the day, whether there was a cover-up or not, that whole process was managed terribly. And at the end of the day, as I said, you don't need a book to disclose that all. This is not a revelation. Everyone saw what happened at the debate, and he was clearly not fit to run for president.
How do the Democrats, I guess, draw a line in the sand in this? I mean, they are paying for the Biden legacy here. It's an ongoing story. To your point, he's come out in the press and Jill Biden's come out and said, well, the people that have spoken on the record in this book, although anonymously, have agreed to be quoted, weren't in the White House with us. And they don't know how hard Joe Biden worked every single day for the... I mean, it just feels like they're having different conversations here. No one is accusing Joe Biden of not having worked for the US government at the highest possible level. No one is accusing him of I guess, not having fulfilled necessarily his duties as president, although there would naturally be disagreements around the politics of it. But how do the Democrats come out and just be like, we are done, this is over, line in the sand, we move on, fresh leadership, we look forward to 2028 and beyond? What is needed to sort of, I guess, get over this? Or is it one of those things where they just have to let this whole thing play out potentially for the next 2, 3 years?
Well, the easiest way to cut a line under it is to have the successor campaign team and candidate and so on, not from the previous administration. So they can't be accused of having been in on the deception, because that's really what the political line of attack is against the Democrats and whoever they might select as a presidential candidate going forward, the likes of Pete Buttigieg, who was transport secretary, or whoever else may have served in the administration, the what Republicans are gearing up for, they must have known about his decline. They must have been a participant in the cover-up, and therefore they must have been willing and a participant in a huge deception on the American people. How can they be fit to hold the presidency? That's basically what the attack line is. So the easiest solution, of course, is to have a clean break from that. But if they find themselves with a candidate or a leadership team that does have people, from the previous administration, which wouldn't be unusual, well, then I think Buttigieg's line so far has been something along every time they engage with the White House, transport department got what they needed, or the whatever it happened to be. So that so they he's made it clear he dealt with the White House. When he dealt with the White House, he got a response, and therefore, it's not the case that he was sitting for half an hour with the president every day and must have noticed his forgetfulness or something like that. It was a very different type of secretary or minister administrating a particular area of government, and their relationship with the broader White House rather than the president is how it's being characterized, to avoid that type of being drawn into dealing with whatever. I mean, the other option, of course, is to say there was no conspiracy to mislead the public, and the best evidence of that is that they let him participate in the debate. Had there been an effort to cover up his decline, he wouldn't have been he wouldn't have participated in debates during the election, and they would have run a very different election. And the decline that did happen happened very rapidly, and then became very apparent on it happening rapidly, and therefore didn't bleed into the previous years of the of his presidency, just as something which manifested itself towards the end. That's also an option, of course. Wissam, what do you think? What would you do if you were advising? I would be clean break as the easiest clean, and but I accept that that might not be where the political ambition sits.
Look, I think anyone sensible would have to say, look, we think that President Biden did some great stuff. He made a mistake. He shouldn't have run. What is also showing is he should have been out there more selling his achievements, etc., during his term, before the debate and at other times, etc. So I think, if I was advising them, it would be very much to say, okay, you've got effectively 2 years before there is a presidential election, and a campaign that starts to kind of ramp up and take form. So by that point, this issue is going, I mean, for sure, 100%, this issue will not be an issue, particularly with the way that the Trump administration is going. So as Democrats, you have one of two choices. You can move on and start, or continue in some Democrats' cases, focusing on the real issues that matter to the American people, the economy, jobs, how the government's been run, all of these sorts of things that are consistently coming up as top issues that people care about and are issues that people are marking Donald Trump down on. You need to continue dealing in those issues and try to hose down any of the kind of infighting that might come out of this. But look, a lot of that also has to do with President Biden himself. I mean, he needs to retreat, and he needs to allow time to go past so that people can remember his legacy as a good one. But what he's incapable of doing is letting go, and he's coming out himself and trying to effectively prove to everyone that he was a great president and that he should have a great legacy. The problem is that people aren't there. People are not receptive to that message. It's too soon. It's too fresh in people's minds that he really screwed up. So I think he needs to get out of the limelight. He needs to get off the stage, and Democrats need to continue focus, as I said, continue in some instances, and start in some other Democrats' instances, to just focus on issues that matter. And look, the Democrats are about as unpopular as they've ever been, certainly in modern history. And I think a lot of that is because a lot of people felt somewhat let down and disappointed with the way that things happened, the way that the candidate was changed halfway through a campaign, the fact that that meant Donald Trump could have a second term. So there's a lot of disappointment in the party, and I think that the leadership of the party, which currently doesn't exist as there is no real standout presidential candidate, but those who are prominent people within the party need to focus on holding Donald Trump, the President Trump, to account on all of those issues that matter to American people.
Yeah, but I mean, I hear what you say, but the easiest response to that is yeah. Whilst I may not say I accept that he isn't doing a good job, I'll say one, he was left with a mess because of Biden's absenteeism during the during his presidency because he was unfit. But also, even if you got all these great ideas, how can the American public trust you? Because you, as a Democrat, have been part of the greatest cover up and fraud on the American voters in the history of America, which was to cover up the fact that the president was in serious mental health decline and risked the security economically and militarily of the nation by having someone who wasn't competent sitting in office. And when you say he should have been out selling the positivity of his successes in the 2 years before the presidential election. He wasn't because he was incapable, is the argument. And the fact he was incapable of doing it means you must have known as the Democratic leadership that that's why he wasn't doing it. And that's why he wasn't being pushed to do it. And therefore you two were part of, again, this grand cover up on his health. I think this will keep coming back, I'm afraid. I don't think the electorate will be allowed to forget this. By Republicans and by the typical Trumpian type attitude to campaigning, which is forget reality, look over here, look at the distraction. And the distraction is you can't trust the Democrats. They lie to you. They lie to you on the health of the president. I'm a healthy president. I wouldn't lie to you on that. And that just we just keep going round on the same circle until someone deals with the fact that there clearly was some form of management of his decline, and the best way of dealing with it is to narrow the time window when you say there was decline, but not such that it would have rendered him incapable of being president. But then,
Yeah, but I think the
if you
definition
supported him as a candidate going forward, then you're acknowledging decline that you knew would continue into the next term.
Yeah, but anybody who comes out as a potential leadership contender is obviously not going to have much links to Biden. I mean, not I mean, they could actively go out and do that and proactively dismiss distance themselves from President Biden. But my point is, President Biden himself needs to get out of the limelight, because once he isn't out of the limelight, whoever is coming up in the next year or two, is obviously not has no reason. Now, Kamala Harris couldn't do it because she was a part of the administration, but naturally they will have to distance it and say, look, President Biden was a good president when it came to certain things, but he should have left earlier, and that that I didn't agree with that, and what have you. These are things that I expect any of them to logically do. I don't think the impact of this is going to be all that great in 2 years' time, considering most of the people who care about this stuff are also likely to be facing some much deeper issues when it comes to their lives around some of the economic hardship they're about to be hit with over the next 12 to 18 months. So I think this is, I'm not saying it's not going to be an issue. I just don't think that there's anything, what's done is done. If there was a cover up, then that is really stupid. But I don't think that they're going to pay electorally the price for it in 2 or 3 years' time, considering what's happening with the economy, considering what's happening with everything else. If you had a clean break, which I don't think is all that possible, to be honest with you. I mean, whoever comes up is going to get criticized for being a Democrat. But that's why the Democrats have a very, very tough task ahead of them over the next 2 or 3 years to rebrand themselves as a party that stands up for working people, the people's the issues that people care about, all of this sort of stuff. At the end of the day, when you're up against a Republican Party who supports somebody who covers up effectively everything, it's kind of, yeah, I just don't. If we were talking about this 10 years ago, I would have agreed with you that I think it would have had a massive impact. But I think people have short-term memories, and if the Democratic Party does the right thing and plays this right, they will be able to overcome this. This is not an election losing issue in certainly not in 2028, but
There's
I don't think
actually
it's
a
gone
joke
down a
in there
huge.
somewhere about you saying the electorate have short-term memories when we talk about the mental decline of a president in office, but it's not one I'm prepared to make.
No, I
So
wouldn't.
maybe we'll draw a line under it,
Yeah.
rather than me be tempted to go any further on that one.
So no, look, I think, I think it the Democrats have this issue, but many other issues to rehabilitate themselves on is effectively what I'm trying to get at. This is one of many issues that they need to win the trust of the American people on.
Well, let's move now to the current president, Donald Trump, and of course, his whirlwind tour of the Middle East, which took in the following countries: Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. His comeback with some investments still in hands, lifting of sanctions of Syria, which were quite historic, and some incredible discussions that he had in that part of the world. Rodney, what did you make of Trump's trip to the Middle East, somewhere where you used to live, of course, and what were some of the highlights and key takeaways for you?
I mean, I mean, look, I quite like the Middle East, as I'm sure you guys know, and I have enjoyed the time that I've spent in Saudi Arabia. I've never been to Qatar, but I've been in virtually everywhere else, and there's a great hospitality. Donald Trump likes to be hosted. And there was certainly a pretty high standard reception for him, and he likes that, and he likes the attention, and the Saudis played it very well. And I think the one thing I thought, and maybe there's a bit of competition between the Saudis and the Qataris, and again that wouldn't be unusual, and the Qataris maybe tried to overshadow the fact that the first stop on the tour was going to be Riyadh, by the airplane, Air Force One successor story and whatever, but I did think that, well done, Saudi Arabia. You want to promote the country on the world stage, you can pay for media, you can pay for billboards, you can pay for advertising, and you can invite the President of the United States, and for whatever time he was there, the world's entire media was on Saudi Arabia. The world was talking about Saudi Arabia. They were talking about, in the commentary around certain parts of the visit, the change in the economy in Saudi Arabia, the young population, the reforms that the Crown Prince had made. And from a Saudi perspective, all this stuff's really positive. I even heard, I think, on BBC and Sky and another news outlet, all reference in the growth in the Saudi tourism offering. So, from a Saudi point of view, hosting that visit is huge projection of what they're trying to do globally, as well as an opportunity to showcase the country. So, yeah, I mean, from a Saudi perspective, great. From a Trump perspective, it was transitional. He was there to preach peace and sell arms. And he came back with a lot of military contracts worth much more than they may turn out to be in reality, given the numbers that he keeps inflating every time he speaks. The key highlight for me was the amount of people that were lined up to shake his hand at various points, and both people he had brought with him, as well as those in Saudi Arabia, government officials and senior leadership and so on. And some of that went on for a long time. Plus his desire to, at one of the news conferences, take everyone through in as much detail as he could with his own lens, all the electoral results in the US election, going state by state and discussing the swings in various states and so on. And that was received with some surprise to the broader audience that he took this opportunity on this platform to decide to go through what was an election that took place last year that, of course, he won, but possibly not in the grand style that he decided he wanted to talk about it. I mean, I don't know what his people tell him he should talk about before he goes out with a microphone in front of him. But I mean, what he does talk about cannot be what they're advising him to go and talk about. And I think maybe they're just at the point where they say, well, he's going to say what he's going to say, and we're going to pick up the pieces afterwards. Obviously, the snub to Israel was significant as well. And we'll see whether that has any, brings any influence to bear on what is Israel does or doesn't do in the coming days and weeks.
I mean, I think I've got to say it was an incredible success for Trump the last week, and I say that because I think he's the only leader in the world who could get Mohammed bin Salman to dance to the Village People. I think on that he gets 10 out of 10. Look, I think there's no doubt that it was a trip that was for the to kind of take the attention away from some of the domestic issues, to make him look like the man about town when it comes to the Middle East. I don't think the optics are so are really that bad. I think, as far as a strategic trip, it wasn't a bad strategic trip. In fact, with the exception of the kind of the Qatari plane. Jetliner kind of gift issue. The rest of it, I think, was pretty well managed and probably looked like, for the domestic audience, a very successful trip. And certainly, if you have a look at the social media response, it looks like that. But again, with everything Trump, the devil's in the detail. I mean, he's talking about $1.2 trillion worth of deals. In fact, the figure went up to 2 billion over the week. Sorry, 2 trillion over the weekend. Just to put that into context, Qatar's annual GDP is 230 billion or something around that number. So, effectively, when you're talking about six times Qatar's annual GDP, this is the value of the deals. And many economists are talking about how a lot of the numbers, very similar kind of accounting and calculations that he did when it came to Dodge and Elon Musk's efforts to save trillions from the budget, and to cut trillions from the budget, apologies. It's a lot of those numbers don't look all that real. Some economists and experts are talking about the fact that, well, it's not just Trump. I mean, many of these sorts of deals were done under previous presidents, Obama, Biden, Trump in the first term. So it's not, these are not unusual type of deals that are made. And most importantly, I think the thing that you've got to underline is that a large number of these were not contracts that were signed. They were memorandums of understanding or agreement, which obviously don't hold the same legal weight as a contract, and often mean that they don't have the same value as you might announce. They don't end up being, there's no real obligation on one party to spend the value that was announced in a press release, for example. So I think, again, if you look at the details, they're all padded up. They look good. They look great for the media. At the end of the day, the Qatar plane gift, thing was a bit of a problem for him, and I think will continue to be a fair bit of a problem for him. You've got people like Lorimer. I think she's talking about how this will be a stain on his presidency. She's a very powerful influencer and quite a right wing kind of figure in the United States, but seems to be very influential, particularly in the right wing media ecosystem. So, she's talking about how what a terrible thing this is, etc. So I think that's a problem politically. But the rest of it, from a political point of view, I think, was pretty good. You had the usual ramblings of him calling Saudi Arabia hot, and then talking about how. Sorry, call himself hot, but then he's saying, well, Saudi Arabia is actually really hot, and some very confusing things in his speech about Saudi Arabia, whether it's hot from a kind of physical appearance point of view, and he was referring to Mohammed bin Salman. I'm not sure. Certainly didn't come across as he was talking about the temperature. But some very odd things that you wouldn't expect a president to kind of say in that environment. But hey, look. It finished with a big embrace of Mohammed bin Salman with the village people playing in the background. I mean, as far as TV goes, mate, you can't ask for any more than that.
So what about China, Ozan? If you're sitting in China, do you think this has drawn the Middle East closer to the US? Or do you think it's pure theater and the Saudi, Qatar, the rest of the Gulf Cooperation Council who had the meeting that Trump attended, they're just playing the US and they'll play both sides of the or they'll pivot to the East when they need to. What's your view on that?
I think there's nothing new in any of this. I mean, presidents going back 20, 30 years have always had very warm relationships with the Gulf countries. So I think I would be surprised if China expected anything different. I think, I don't think that. Now, of course, the theatre of all of this and the roadshow and the bells and whistles of all of this was much more kind of in your face and out there, and was much more apparent. But I don't think the Qataris and the Saudis and the Gulf generally love the fact that there is a transactional president in the White House. But when you had a different president, it's not like these sorts of deals didn't happen and these sorts of events or these sorts of kind of meetings didn't happen. In fact, if you remember Donald Trump's first foreign visit in his first term was to Saudi Arabia. He has deep, deep business relationships there. Well, his family does, and I think he probably does as well. And it is exactly the right place to go when you want to make deals and when you want to make transactional kind of announcements like this. And it strengthens his political standing. It strengthens the image that he's trying to portray to the domestic electorate. So I would be very surprised if China was surprised by this or shocked by it or was worried about it, because I suspect, if China, if President Xi Jinping went over to on a Middle East trip as widely publicized as this, I'm sure he's probably going to get as warm welcome as Donald Trump. I'm not sure he could convince Mohammed bin Salman to dance to the village people, though. That's one thing I don't think he can probably do. So.
Now, that would be an interesting sight for sure. You never say never in politics. I only should have learnt that in your many years following and actively working in this space. But let's head over to Europe now, where there's multiple elections that we want to touch on here on Put Simply this week, starting with Portugal, where the ruling centre-right alliance has won the election, with the far right also making record gains. Considering what's happening around the world in terms of the rejection of I guess, conservative politics and the movement on the right, Rodney, was this a surprise to you?
I mean, it's been that Portugal's lacked stability for some time. There are issues, live issues around immigration. There is obviously this Ventura and the populist grouping. I think the This has been a push for a few years now, so it's not something that suddenly just emerged. And although they made progress, they didn't make the same progress as populist parties have made elsewhere. And obviously, the prime minister is likely to form the next government. I mean, the government came down with a vote of no confidence because of some allegations around a conflict of interest, I think, with a family law firm. Those who brought down the government haven't been the beneficiaries of the outcome, and all it is just an erosion of their position, and a replacement by a growth in the populist vote. So Montenegro will form the next government. The issues who with he's ruled out working with the populist in Chega, and it's really important, I guess, that Portugal forms a government that has a level of stability that sees them not have a fourth election in 4 years, and they can probably start to offer something different, because at the moment, the instability is what's giving the populace the momentum that they're able to campaign on. So yeah, it's not. I mean, if you're concerned about populism, obviously Canada and Australia were positive outcomes, and in a sense, Portugal and Romania, which we may come on to talk about, are of a similar outcome in that the populace haven't seized the throne.
It's also very interesting. I think, there is now a trend in the elections that we were also discussing, and obviously the world experienced last year, and that is around having, incumbents being punished by the electorate. You're almost seeing something that's quite different to that, and I suppose it's no surprise, considering we've been talking about it for a few weeks now, that the level of uncertainty in the economy and amongst the general public in most countries is very high. So obviously, I think despite the fact that Prime Minister Montenegro had a number of conflicts of interest allegations and what have you, he managed to kind of keep the share of vote. In fact, he increased the share of votes from the last time around. So I think he's going to end up getting 9 extra seats from 80 to 89. But what was interesting is that the Socials Party, or the centre left party, went backwards quite significantly. And I understand the Pedro Nuno Santos has effectively resigned. So you're seeing in a number of places incumbents kind of proving to be, perceived as a safe pair of hands in these uncertain times, and some of these more left, centre left parties going backwards in Europe. So, yeah, it's interesting.
And on the theme of elections, you mentioned Romania, Rodney. What's happening there?
Oh yeah, well, we had an interesting outcome. Obviously, it was the runoff in the presidential election, and this is the one where we had the previous election annulled, with Georgescu excluded, populist right, and it was excluded because of Russian interference, and then it was rerun, and his replacement as the populist right, Simeon, was the leader after the first stage, and then it went down to the two horse race, and he actually had as well as some of the other mad things he said he was going to appoint Georgescu as prime minister if he was elected, which is class, obviously, playing very heavily to carry over his supporter base. But no, instead, the former mayor of Bucharest, Nicușor Dan, won the election. So centrist, pretty sensible, got nearly 54% of the vote. So all the anti-populist vote consolidated around him. And I think, to quote one prominent Romanian MP, he summed it up by just saying Romania's just dodged a bullet, and that's how they view it. So from an EU perspective, this is positive. From a NATO perspective, this is positive. During his time as mayor of Bucharest, he was prominent on anti-corruption and particularly against property developers, which might not warm his relationship with Donald Trump too well. He's seen as a steady, hard-working, smart, potential leader. There'll be no change in foreign policy, and yeah, he's being characterized already as the Romanian Merkel, which is measured, steady, smart. So yeah, from a European Union perspective, it couldn't be better. I mean, there's a broader issue about this substantial minority in so many countries, which is voting for populists. And the challenge for all these centrist leaders as they come in. So again, this is like Canada and Australia in terms of rejecting, is to demonstrate sufficient reforms and positive outcomes, which start to erode the populist opposition. But yeah, from a EU and NATO perspective, this probably couldn't have been any better.
Well, speaking of outcomes, Ozan, take us home with the Polish presidential elections, which in the first round was a photo finish.
Yeah, it was an incredibly close kind of contest, with a quite a high turnout too, I believe, just under 68%. And you've got on one side the incumbent, or the mayor of Warsaw, and he's got the support of the incumbent government. And then you've got on the other side the conservative candidate Karol Nawrocki from the party PiS. I'm not going to try and say the whole thing because my Polish is not all that good, and I'm going to make a very bad mess of it. But yeah, so it seems to be that the Rafał Zarowski, the mayor of Warsaw, received just over 31%, and the Nawrocki received just under 30, so 29.5. It's a little bit different, I think, from some of the other elections on this one. You don't have a massively kind of populist drive. The PiS party is the conservative party, but not all that right wing or super kind of populist from that point of view. So it seems that whoever wins there, for obvious geopolitical reasons, I think they're in a very different position to most of other Europe, being on being so close to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, having received so many Ukrainian migrants, refugees. They're in a different, I think, place politically. But it seems that the mayor of Warsaw, who's leading, also is quite pro-Western, pro-NATO. As I mentioned, it doesn't seem like the opposition is all that different in a lot of those views. But of course, they are more conservative, more right-wing on many other things. Let's see. June 1, I think, is the runoff.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be optimism that that this will fall, the pro-EU, pro-NATO, anti-Russia, anti-populist way as well. But yeah, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, you're right. I think there are differences between the PIS and the kind of ruling party in terms of some of the around refugees and what have you. But generally speaking, I don't see it as a it's not like the Albanian Trump light or some of the other populist countries or parties in some of the other countries that have had elections recently. I think they seem to be a bit more measured, and there seems to be more consensus around NATO and what the role of NATO should be.
Well, let's see where that election lands up, and no doubt we will analyze the results here on Put Simply. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this week. See you next.
Thank you.
Thanks.